This is the beginning of class 9.
Sanshi Bhagi Jushin Neto Jam Vira Vinci Nyende Yampadi Sange Shindu Mite Uwagi Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dagni Kapsuchi Dagi Chunyen Dupe Sunangki Drola Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Vadu Dami Kapsuchi Dagi Chumyen Gimpe Sunangi Drola Penche Sangye Jupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Vadu Dami Suci dahi cemen kita senangi jola kenci sange juhasu.
Last week was depressing, right? What was that?
What did we do last week?
This is worse, okay? Tonight is worse. But anyway, I thought you should know the bad ones. At least you can avoid them. This is something, these are the five worst bad things. The five, we call them, I don't know how to pronounce it, heinous bad things. Some here means interim, and may means no interim. And what it means is, if you do one of these five in this life, you will be born in hell, and you won't have any other birth in between. You must go to hell your very next life, and there's no other possibility.
Can I just ask, how do you get out of hell?
You wear out the bad deeds. You just suffer, and the bad deeds, the bhakchaks, are flower, and as they flower, they finish, and then sooner or later you stop seeing hell, and you start seeing another birth. You know?
What leads to that? What leads to that shift?
It just wears out. There's a priority system, right? So whichever ones were stronger, whichever bhakchaks were stronger, and whichever were towards a more holy object, and those get worn out first, and then they assert themselves earlier because they're stronger, and then as those wear out, then the ones waiting behind them in queue, you know, start to assert themselves until finally you don't have any more bhakchaks to experience a life in hell, and you're born somewhere else. But you can die. There are hells where you can be beaten to death, and then you just wake up again, and they keep beating you until you die, and then you just wake up again, and they beat you. You know. Yeah.
I had asked last class on why anger was so much more powerful than virtue, and you said that you would answer.
Did I?
Yes.
I don't know.
No. I heard that. Just
so it's my second ask.
Who was it? You, John. You were in Arizona. Maybe you remember.
I mean, I actually asked the question, why doesn't one moment of anger destroy one moment of virtue?
Yeah.
You know, and he just said, well, you can't understand the subtle workings of karma.
You can't understand the subtle workings.
I'll ask it again eventually.
He just said, well, you can't understand the subtle workings of karma.
You can't understand the subtle workings.
I'll ask it again eventually. Again.
I'll check. You can tell her. I will check. I forgot this one. But I can ask about this one. There's a long thing in the Majjhimika scriptures because it's so extraordinary. You know, Shanti Deva's statement that you lose 100 kalpas of virtue for every second of anger is so extraordinary that they do discuss it. And I'll look at it.
Could you say something about this idea of merit and virtue? Are you using that interchangeably?
I'm using them interchangeably. Technically, merit and virtue,
same
you translate them as sunam and gewa, are a little bit different.
But when people say, you know, you're accumulating merit, you know, you need
it's
a lot of
you
merit.
You can think of good karma, which is bhakti.
So you've got to accumulate a lot of a certain kind of bhakshak, is mm-hmm. all they're saying.
Yeah.
Never leads you to feel
good. Not the kind of bhakshak that creates a what we call a numbing result, a ripened, technically a result of temporary pleasure or temporary pain. But
it's only saying emptiness, song and industry.
No, you must collect virtue because those virtues allow you, all the definition of virtue was what? I mean, in the short run, blah blah blah. In the long run, there is that good result. It does. You do have to plant jillions of bhakshaks to see yourself as a Buddha. That's true. And then while you're being a Buddha, they feed on each other. You achieve fusion, you know, where the fuel creates more energy than the result, the reaction is more energy than the fuel. And that's what he's doing. The Buddha is just doing that. Okay, summing up. So san means intermediate birth. Man means none. Na means five. So we call it the five immediate nistis, five immediate dharmas. Immediate means there's no medium between them. You do it in the life in which you collect the karma, you must experience hell as which of those three? Do you remember the three experiences?
Immediate.
It's the
next
second
life.
One. Yeah. One kind of karma you have experiences in this life, one kind of karma you have experiences in the beyond the next life, and then this is that middle one. Kenin Yongir Gyuti. You must experience it in the next life, immediately, with no intermediate birth. Is there no bardo? No, there is a bardo. You know, some Buddhist scholars have said that means that there's no bardo, but that immediately, with no intermediate birth. Is there no bardo? No, there is a bardo. You know, some Buddhist scholars have said that means that there's no bardo, but that's not true. They don't accept that. Immediate means in the next rebirth life. They don't count bardo in that. Yeah.
So it's not just that the experiencing of the result in the next life, it also produces the next life as well, right?
It is a panjekile. It must be. Mm-hmm. It's not just a dzogchenkile. But we'll get into that. We'll get into another argument about that.
Michael?
So,
yeah? If my train makes his presence known, does that have any effect on things
you couldn't
in hell?
See him.
If you were in hell?
No, I mean... People who Getsache, you know, who cut that root of virtue, they create what are called jippas. And jippas are like bhakchaks. They're kind of energy that stays in your mental stream, and they obstruct you from seeing those beings. You couldn't see them. You'd go to meet the Dalai Lama and you'd get in a car accident, you know. you couldn't see them. Or you'd think, there was a monk named Ledgar who served the Buddha for 12 years, and he said, I never saw any worthwhile quality that he had. I think I might have heard something. I think she might have. You know, so he got this. The quote is in the sutras. He has this little halo around his head, but otherwise, I've never seen anything extraordinary. I've served him for 12 years. I haven't seen anything unusual about him at all. So it's possible. Tamenga. Right? So I'll give you the five. They're very important to know, obviously. Okay. It's a big subject in the Abhidhamma. And it's accepted by all schools. Say ma.
Ma.
Sopa.
Sopa.
Ma.
Ma.
Sopa.
Sopa.
What do you think ma means?
Ma.
Ma. Ma. Okay. Ma means mother. Sopa means to kill. To murder.
To kill your mother.
Right, that's the first in the list. By the way, first in the list doesn't mean the most serious. We're going to get into that later. That this list is the traditional order, but it's not in order of any severity. So Ma-sopa is the first one. You'll see a debate in your reading. I thought you'd find it interesting, so I threw it in there. since I have time though, because I'm not working. Is what if a woman conceives a child and then the embryo is transferred to the womb of another woman? Which woman does he have to kill to get a masa? You know, after he's born and grows up. And they say the one who conceived him. So, even if he spent all 8 months or something, you know, in another woman's womb. So,
what if the woman dies in childbirth? Doesn't he sort of indirectly kill her?
There are four ways of being born, and it's covered in the first chapter, I think, or the second chapter. And there's a list, you know, there's four ways you can be born: from an egg, from a womb, from heat and wetness, and then from, you can be born complete, like Padmasambhava was born complete, you know, just as the hell beings are born complete. They just show up there already ready to suffer. They don't go through a childhood or anything. And they say those births are rated by preference, and the womb birth is like rated kind of low because it hurts the mother so much. But I don't know. I don't think there's no intention, right? There's no identification. There's no undertaking. The only thing you have is a completion. So probably some karma. By the way, the whole point of that, talking about those four elements and then the three elements inside the second element, was that you can decide now yourself what's a good deed or a bad deed. You know, it's not a full karmic path to bad deeds, but you know there was a completion. She did have the pain. Well, I think you can get close. I was close. My mother asked me to help kill her, you know, when she had cancer. And then also I was sort of, you know, I told her to take Tibetan medicine and not to do her radiation treatments. And, you know, I mean, you have to be careful about it. You can, out of carelessness, you can contribute, you know. You have to be careful.
And if you had said yes and you went ahead and gave them permission and they pulled the plug right before she would have died anyway and you didn't know the difference, it wouldn't have been a complete karma.
Yeah, right. But luckily it didn't work out. I mean, I didn't have to make the decision. Okay. Dachomba, say Dachomba Sopa?
Dachomba Sopa.
What's it, Dachomba? Arhat, okay? Arhat. Da means enemy. What's your big enemy?
Ignorance.
Mainly ignorance, but the other five major afflictions and, you know, pride, anger, hatred. Dra is the enemy. Jo means to destroy. Arhat means foe destroyer. Sometimes you see it translated as foe destroyer. And if you remove those permanently, you achieve nirvana. So you could have done it this afternoon, you could do it tonight.
And sopa is to kill?
Yeah, sopa means to kill. So to kill an arhat. Say gendingi.
Gendingi.
Yenchepa.
Yenchepa.
Gendingi.
Gendingi.
Yenchepa.
Yenchepa.
Okay. Gendin means what? You know? Gendin? First time I know his name. Gendin means Sangha. The Sangha. The community of monks. It has to be, technically, when you study Vinaya, it has to be four monks or more. You don't have a Gendin. It's like a quorum of monks. A single monk is not called a Gendin. It's a Gelong. And then four monks or more is a Gendin. So, Gendengi, Yen. Yen means to divide or to split up. Chepa means to do that. So this means to cause a schism in the community of monks. To split up the monks. Gendengi, Yen, Chepa.
In the previous one, did we have to have proper identification? Last class you were
talking
about.
That's a good question. That is a good question.
You said the motivation didn't matter.
Well, they said it was less important in that case of that extraordinary object, whether you, you know, in the case of the Bodhisattva.
Right.
I don't believe you have to. I think it's from the point of view of there being such an extraordinary object and not to do with your motivation. I don't think you have to know that they're a Dachomba to get their karma. In fact, I can think of an example. Udayana was killed by his son. And I don't believe he had any idea he was the one. You know, I don't remember any mention that the son cared or knew about it.
You can get bad karma just for thinking badly or speaking badly to an arhat, whether you know that that's what they are or not, according to what the Buddha taught us in the last class, because you don't know.
Yeah, he's asking, like, you get a full karmic path. You know, it would seem like you'd have to know to collect a full karma, and does it have to, would it be still be a tsamme if you didn't have identification? I believe it is. Just from this extraordinary nature of the object. Okay. Last one. It's a long one. Say, Daishegla. Nyansamgi.
Nyansamgi.
Trajimba.
Trajimba.
Daishek means a Buddha. Daishegla. Sugata. Those who have gone to happiness. La, to him. Nyansamgi. Nyansam means with evil intention. And it means that you really wanted to kill him. With an evil intention. It means that you really were intending to kill him. Trap Jimba means, trap means blood. And Jimba means to draw the blood of the Buddha. With evil intentions. Okay? And they say, in the this is Abhidharma system, right? Because a Buddha can't suffer, obviously. Right. But there is a story in the Hinayana scripture. Well, it's in the scriptures that the Buddha's half brother, who was insanely jealous of the Buddha throughout his whole life, you know, prepared a. And several people tried to murder the Buddha. I mean, people invited him to dinner and tried to murder him. I mean, it wasn't like nothing worked. But and there was he made a catapult. The brother made a catapult and waited for him. Shot the catapult, it hit the Buddha's leg, it made a small cut on his foot. In Mahayana way, the Buddha was just allowing him to do it and pretending to bleed. But a Buddha can't, technically a Buddha can't suffer. But that's, the Abhidharma position is that just to even try to do it is the bad deed.
So to try to kill?
Yeah, to try. It means to try to kill a Buddha, but it does say to draw blood from a Buddha with evil intention. Those five can get you to to hell directly. So I've been real good about some people at home.
Michael?
Yeah.
The fourth one causes schism.
Yeah.
Would that include a situation, for instance, if you have a group of clergy where you have a teacher who's not that great, perhaps?
No. We're going to go into it very deeply.
All right.
I mean, we're going to spend a lot of time on it. By the way, now that you've mentioned it, number four of all of them will always cause you to be born in the lowest hell. It's called Avicii. Okay? The lowest hell. Hell where you have absolutely not a second's respite. Not a second. There isn't a single moment when you are not experiencing a pain which is beyond any pain that anyone can feel in this world.
Why is it?
Why?
Why number four?
We're going to talk about it.
We had this, these five in a previous course.
Yeah.
And you've emphasized on several different occasions that it's impossible, technically, to...
We're going
to
talk about it. I know. We're going to talk about it. Trust me. So, the other four, you have to go to hell, but not necessarily to the lowest hell. All right? Number four, Genden Yenche, to split up the Sangha, that you must go to the lowest hell. And you must stay there for one parakel. Parakelp, there's a beautiful thing in the Abhidharma third chapter. It describes how the universe forms over the period of, I think it's 60 kalpas. I tried to figure out what a kalpa is. Kalpa is very difficult. Buddha Rinpoche back in 1300s tried to calculate it. The definition of a kalpa is something like this. I mean, the first people on this planet lived like in a paradise, like a Garden of Eden. Their lifespan is up to 80,000 years long. They live to 80,000. And then they start to mess up. And there's a beautiful story. So it's very similar to the Garden of Eden story. And they start to commit non-virtues. And then eventually, because of that, generation after generation, they reach a point where people live only 10 years old. So to calculate the length of an eon, you'd have to have a kalpa. You'd have to figure. You'd have to do this mathematics. I haven't got it straight. It's many, many zeros, 60 zeros or something.
Is this the Abhidhamma?
It's accepted in all schools.
No, but I mean,
it is in the third chapter. It's at the end. It's a beautiful thing. I can give it to you sometime. Translate it.
Is every world system like that, or just this?
Every world system follows the same pattern. So that's one called a parkal. And there's 60 of those cycles. People start. It's like a nuclear war. It's very similar to a nuclear war. And only the people living out in the wilderness survive. And then they meet in the towns, which are all ruined and destroyed, and the people are all dead. And they say, look, this is terrible. We should really follow the 10 virtues, you know. So they all decide to follow them. And then the lifespan starts to increase again. So there's this huge thing. That's a parkal. The time that takes to go to 80,000 years of lifespans in one generation down to 10 again, you know, that's a parkal. 60 of those make a great eon. And a great eon has the formation of the world is there, that takes the kalpa, and then the destruction of the world by one of several means, one of which is like an atomic fire. One is that the sun supernovas and destroys the planet. And there's beautiful, it's in the Abhidhamma. So a kalpa is a hell of a long time, no pun intended. And you have to stay a parkal in the lowest hell.
Parkal
is one of those loops.
160.
Yeah. Yes. I don't even want to guess, but it's trillions of years. More than. Yeah.
What happens if someone causes a schism in the sangha of being laity and non-clergy? Is that?
We'll talk about it.
All right.
We'll
talk about it.
Okay.
Causes a schism in the sangha or in the community of monks. And which way do you mean it?
Well, I'm talking about tonight is this samme. This is a very specific deed, and I'm going to talk more about it. When I say sangha, I mean monks, ordained monks. I don't mean. He's talking about literal sangha. Literal sangha is anyone who's seen emptiness directly. Once you've seen emptiness directly, you're sangha. You're the real sangha. And then this is we are the figurative sangha. People we are wrong to. We're not the real.
So this refers to the real or the
no, figurative? The figurative.
The figurative.
Okay. We have another profile. Okay. Profile of the person who commits this. And then you get into, you see, this deed, the tsamme, the immediate misdeed of this, has to be done, luckily, while a Buddha is on the planet. While the historical Buddha is on the planet. Because it's dividing his direct followers.
Oh, so it's only his guys.
We can't do this now. We cannot commit this. Okay, it has to be done while the Buddha is present on the planet.
You're from number five?
No, the number four hand. The splitting up of the monks has to be done on this planet. And it's a historical event. It's a historical pattern that reoccurs on each planet. And there's a lot of details about when it can take place. But basically, I better give you all the details. The monk who does the split, the monk who incites the split, first of all, he's a monk. He's a full monk. He's a gelo. He's a bhikshu. He has to be a full monk. Secondly, he has a very good morality. He keeps his morality very well. Thirdly, he's very intelligent. He's an intellectual type. They say he has to be pretty attractive. He has to be, like, charismatic, because he has to break up the followers of the Buddha. So he's not a dumbhead. He's an ultimate dumbhead, but he knows his stuff. He can recite all the scriptures. He's
smart.
His reputation is good. You know, he's a good monk, and and then he sets forth a list of five things to achieve nirvana, and that don't have anything to do with it. Like, you can't eat yogurt, and you shouldn't wear these robes with the patches on them and things like that. There's a, it's a list. Don't eat meat, he says.
Are you saying this is the case of all world systems, or just this one?
It seems to
be
that the Abhidharma is saying that this is a pattern in world systems. But there's always, and then there's a, you can read it in your reading, but there's a limit of time. It can only happen 12 years after the Buddha has first started teaching. During the first 12 years of the Buddha's teaching, everyone is so happy and so into it that they have this kind of special unity, and it can't happen. And it's like a Dharma center. I mean, this, you know, when you're first learning everything, it's very fresh, it's very interesting. I sooner or later I'll run out of interesting new things to tell you, and then it's just whether you practiced it or not, you know. I mean, right now it's kind of interesting, not only because you're practicing it, but because it's the first time you've heard a lot of things. There will come a time when you will have heard everything, and I can get up here and repeat it, but then it's just a question of whether you've practiced it or not. And then it's not as fresh, it's not as interesting, I can tell you. And it's a very dangerous stage to reach. They describe it in the scriptures. It's called butter on leather. Like if you keep butter in a leather pouch, then sooner or later the leather gets saturated, it starts to crack, and can't absorb any more butter. And that's a danger, it's a spiritual danger, that you reach a point where you heard all these things. And what you're really attracted to is more information and not practicing it. That's a very dangerous point. So anyway, it can't happen right after the Buddha's... It doesn't happen also right after the Buddha starts teaching. It cannot. Because everyone is so happy. The 12 years thing is that the Buddha, after the Buddha starts teaching, and as his followers spread out over that country or that planet, they start to introduce corruptions into the teaching. And the last page of the Abhidharma is very sad. I mean, you cry when you read it. You know, you spend 2, 3, 4 years studying Abhidharma. You get to the last page, and the Buddha describes how the teachings will die. You know, he goes through long descriptions of how they will die, when they will die, why they will die. You know, his own teachings, he sees they will die out in the world.
So the Abhidharma was written by the Buddha?
No, but the Vasubandhu, it's pretty much a compendium from the sutras. So he quotes the sutras. And if you get to read the sutras eventually, they're quite nice. You see everything. Yesterday I saw this, found a lot of quotations about... They say the Tibetan Buddhists made up all these things about Lama devotion and things, but the sutras are even more radical. I was reading one yesterday. It's 1,000 pages long. Very powerful. So, anyway, it can't happen right after the Buddha starts teaching. It cannot happen in the first 12 years. It cannot happen at the end of his life. We call it when he reaches his final nirvana. I always used to be confused about that expression. You hear it in Hinayana a lot, you know. The Buddha reaches his final nirvana. I said, well, what's the difference between his final nirvana and his original nirvana? You know, is it really nirvana? Because he achieved nirvana a long time before that. He got rid of his bad thoughts. I always used to confuse it. That nirvana has nothing to do with, you know, the normal nirvana. It just means for the Buddha to withdraw his emanation from this planet. So when they say the Buddha reaches his parinirvana, it has nothing to do with nirvana. It's just the act of withdrawing his emanation from this planet. And according to Mahayana, he doesn't die. Obviously he doesn't die. He just decides to withdraw. He doesn't even decide. It's an automatic process when there's not enough people on the planet to benefit. If no one on the, it's like Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, if there's not one good person on the planet to see the Buddha, the emanation is withdrawn automatically. He appears to die.
Is the point of teaching 4 and 5 now, when that's not an issue, to keep that line pure so that information keeps...
That's one, and then we're going to talk more about it. There's what we call the Nyewe Tsambe, the close to the 5. There's 5 that are close to the 5. Okay? And that's also dangerous. They also lead to a helper. Definitely lead to a helper. So, that's another... What else? It cannot occur before the 2 major students appear. That's Shariputra and Maudgalyayana. You want their names? These are called the supreme pair. They're called the pair. And the only other word that pair is used is in the secret teachings for a special. It involves the word for tantric enlightenment. But anyway, that supreme pair must be on the planet for the schism to occur, because they patch it up within 24 hours. One of them brings the monks back together within 24 hours.
So you mean this is a pattern that takes place every time?
It seems to be a pattern that happens.
That there is a Buddha.
It seems like
on
that.
Any
That's
planet.
The feeling you get if you translate it. Yeah.
It feels like strangely that. Detailed.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It can't happen after the Buddha. I'm sorry, the reason it couldn't happen when he passed away was that, right after he passes away, is that everyone is too sad. There's a unity brought about by the depression of the students. They're so upset. They're so mutually and communally upset that they can't think to him. And you'll see the others in your reading. Yeah.
Are you describing something that inevitably happens every time a Buddha appears, or if it's going to happen while a Buddha appears, it happens this way?
I don't know for sure. The Abhidharmas say that this particular Buddha, Shakyamuni, by the way, there's thousands of Buddhas, and if you read the scriptures, I mean, you'll see. Yes. But Shakyamuni was not the first, he's not the last. There's 1,000 in just this eon, just in this world, there'll be 1,000. On other planets, there have been many others. And the Abhidharma says that when he was a bodhisattva in a previous life, he caused a dissension in the followers of another Buddha. And as a karmic result of that, he has to go through this thing. But that would be a kind of suffering that's not accepted by the higher school. But there is a process by which for 24 hours a certain monk, and it also can't take place in the direct presence of the Buddha, he goes out for a while to another place, and then there's a troublemaker who splits up the monks during that time. It all sounds very, once you put it in a nice historical perspective, you get sort of this relief that you can't do it nowadays. But the reason I want to spend so much time on it is that you know and I know that most Dharma centers have some dissension. It's not the exception, it's almost the rule, and it's just, Tibetans would say that it stems from the goodness of the activity, that it attracts obstacles, that the practice of trying to improve your spiritual life attracts demons. And if you've never met a demon, you think they don't exist. The day you meet a demon, you'll know. The day you really recognize a demon, there is such a thing. There are demons.
You mean a person who...
There are people who are demons, yeah, and they do things like this. And you will know it. The day you meet one, you'll say, oh, then there really are demons. It wasn't just a thing. And it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous.
But this guy is supposed to be a demon? No.
No. This one. We cannot commit this one, but you're worse than a demon. I mean, if you need a demon, that's a demon.
I don't get what you mean by a demon. A person?
I mean, you will meet a being who looks like a person that you have known and who you thought was a regular human being. And he'll in a very mild way suggest that you do something, try to sway you towards a certain action, and at that moment, he truly is a demon. He is a spirit who, not a human being, but an evil spirit who wants to harm you.
Why isn't he just a human being trying to harm you?
Worse than that, anyway.
Humans all the time. Humans are trying to teach you to do things.
I know. Not that. It'll come at a very important time. more at the most important, very crucial time. Like when if you made a mistake, you could make a whole lifetime mistake. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that I just want to anticipate it. As this group gets larger, or as this group goes longer, it may not get larger, I don't know. But you will meet the person in this group who irritates you. It always happens. And it happened to me. I confess it. You know, I found people that in my life I disliked them the strongest of anybody, and it took me many years. What I say is don't give in to it and don't believe it, you know. It's a very evil thing. It's a very bad thing, dirty thing. And it'll happen. You will meet someone in this study that you really don't like. Or you will start to draw judgments about other traditions of Buddhism. And just don't do it. You know, just be happy, study on your own, do your best not to feel that way. If you can't overcome it, avoid the person. But don't ever let it reach a point where you're sure that you're right. You're wrong. And don't believe yourself, you know. And it will come. It will come. And I will hate to see it. I know it will come someday. And it's what, you know, I've seen students leave Dharma centers because of the politics in the Dharma centers. People grabbing for power, and they can't agree with each other. And it will come, you know. The longer we go, the better we do, the more sure it is that something will come. There have been horrible divisions in major centers. And I want to anticipate it, and I want to say, when the day comes, you know, maybe it already happened that you met that person who really bothered you. You say, I don't believe this person can be a Dharma student. It's probably you. And don't believe it. I mean, don't give in to it. Fight it. It's a demon. You know, it's a real bad thing. And it is, it's not at Sammekile. You don't collect a karma which must take you to the lowest hell in the very next life. But I assure you, it's close. I'm sure it takes you to hell to cause any kind of disunity among Dharma students. You know, it was very, very bad. And with other centers and other lamas and other traditions, just, you don't, when I mean don't, I don't say you have to believe them, because I believe that some of them are flatly wrong, and I think the scriptures show it. And I would not follow those people. And I think the longer you study, the more educated you become as a Buddhist, you know, because this is the scriptures. And it makes sense. But you do not criticize them, and you do not criticize their followers. And the Dalai Lama is very good that way. I've never heard him say anything like that. He's very good at, you know, the questions come, and he, you know, he jumps out of the way, you know. He's very good. You know, there's a lot of things a Buddhist scholar like him could say to blow away Christians. And then on the other hand, he just takes great pains to make sure everyone feels good, and that he respects the good points of each thing. And I just anticipate it. And I say, you know, when the day comes, you're in this class, you go over there to have tea, somebody says something, you really hate this person. Don't believe it. Stop it at the root. Stop it at the beginning. We don't have it now. We will have it probably. No, stop it as it comes up. It is a very horrible, bad deed, and we'll see why. The reason why, well, we'll do it later. Yeah.
Let me ask you a pragmatic question.
Yeah.
What if you are affiliated with the Dharma Center eventually now, where you're, say, on a governing board, you have to make certain decisions, and you either have to get rid of people, and or a teacher, what about that? Is that going to cause a scandal?
I've had this problem. We, you know, there's another thing. It happens in a monastery where one monk has, he's dishonored the robes or something he's done which is flatly, we can't keep that. It's in the Vinaya. The process for removing that person from the monastery is in the Vinaya. You know what I mean? And it's required. You're required to remove the person from the monastery. Depending on whether he confesses, or depending on whether he gives up his viewpoints, or depending on what he does, he can stay in the monastery and take a lower position, or he can, or you're required to ask him to leave. But it's very gingerly. I mean, the territory there is very delicate. In the Bodhisattva vows, you're not allowed to kick out certain people from the monastery, you know, because they're not meditating enough, or they're not studying enough. They're concentrating on one or the other. So it's very delicate. So you have to be very careful. I think you have to be very careful. And if the person has dishonored, then, you know, you have to... If the person is truly an evil influence in that group, then you have to get the person out of the group. And it's a very hard decision. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. And you have to... I think the general thing is to think of them as your mother. You know, if it was your mother, would you do that? You know? And in some cases, you would. To protect the group, to save the group. It's a very delicate question. It's a very difficult question. I've been involved with that. Among the monks, and we had that happen. It's very delicate. You have to be very compassionate, and then you have to make sure that it's really hurting the spiritual progress of everyone else. So that's a big decision. The Buddha used to leave those decisions to Shariputra because he could read people's minds. One day he made a mistake, and the Buddha called the person back. He was called Pelgin. He did not Pelgin. Alright. So that's Genden Gyenje. By the way, this is also called the breaking of the wheel. Which wheel do you guess?
What is it called?
It's called breaking the wheel of the Dharma. I'm concentrating now on the schism. Okay. It's also called the breaking of the wheel of the Dharma. Especially in the Abhidharma system, the wheel of the Dharma, the true wheel of the Dharma, is the understandings of selflessness. And during this 24-hour period, no one in the world can perceive emptiness directly. It's the nature of that disruption of the harmony of the whole world. No one can achieve a new path, a new realization. People's study is disrupted. People can't think straight. People can't recite scriptures. All these, you'll read it in your reading, but it's very, you get the feeling that it's such a horrible deed and such a terrible thing that it disrupts the vibrations of the entire planet. People cannot enter into deep meditation during that 24 hours. And it's very... It's also in a Dharma center. You know that. You've seen centers like that. You know, when it went rotten, it disrupted everyone's practice. Yes,
could you say that it has a similar planetary effect on a lesser scale? You
know? Yeah, I would say so. I think I've seen that. So that's also called breaking the wheel. Okay? Breaking the wheel of the teachings. You know that Dharma chakra, eight spoke wheel. I think we'll take a break.
Can we get English for five, even if you leave it on the killer?
Killing your mother?
No,
that last one you didn't do it in translation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think the Tibetan spelled out would be nifty too.
Transliterated.
The deed's so bad, you know, what's so bad about it? Why is it just those five and no other deeds? All right, and there's an explanation. Things that make it so. I guess we could say four. No, because there's two combinations of two deeds. Okay. Say pembeshi.
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 Pemba means assistance or help. Pembeshi means an object of assistance. And what it means is. This she, you had it in the study of the four parts of the deed. It was the object towards whom you did the deed. So that's here. The she means basis, but it means the object towards whom you do the deed. How many of them are killing? What's the nature of those five deeds?
Kill the mother, kill the father.
Three of them are murder. Then?
Dividing.
One of them is a lie. The nature of the bad deed of a schism. It's not the schism itself. It's the lie that the monk tells to produce the schism. And he proposes this new route to nirvana, and he gives us five things, and that's a lie.
So you're presupposing he's intentionally doing it, not just...
Oh, he does.
That he knows better, and he just wants to divide the sangha.
He's lying.
It's not out of ignorance that he thinks he knows a better
Apparently
way.
Apparently not. It's a zoom. It's a zoom mind. It's a lie.
Could you explain how, a person could want to kill a Buddha, divide a sangha, or cause evil?
It's pretty... Well, by the way, the last one is attempted murder, okay? So we got three murders, one attempted murder, and one lying. I don't know, why does anyone do a bad deed? Why do the Germans kill the Jews? You get into... a milieu which even a good person gets swept away, and you know that we're capable of very horrible things if we get in the wrong circumstances. Any one of us is, we are lucky that we are not hungry and we don't need a place to stay and we don't need money for a habit, or we probably do similar things. I remember when the oil crisis happened, and I used to be so proud of Americans because they weren't like these Indians who beat each other up to get on a bus. But then there were all these fist fights broke out and people shot each other. And I remember that. And then it occurred to me we're all the same. It's not that we're better. We just didn't need it. It can happen to anybody. Pembeshi. So Pembeshi means help. And two of those objects qualify here. There are five objects involved in those five bad deeds. Two of them are special because they have helped you.
Buddha and the Arna? Or your mother?
Or your parents. Okay. Specifically, material help in this life. Okay. Your mother and your father.
Oh, so that means...
This refers to your mother and your father.
Oh, the Pempeshi?
Yeah. They are an extraordinary object. When you kill them, as opposed to killing anyone else, it qualifies as an immediate misdeed, as one of the five big ones, because of the benefit they have given you. And I studied that last night, and it's very interesting. Nowhere did I see much mention of gestating you, or feeding you, or taking care of you, or it was all, every mention of them, was that they gave you a body to reach nirvana and benefit. They gave you a body, a life with which you could achieve the ultimate.
So it
doesn't matter if they're a good mommy or a bad mommy or a nice daddy or a lousy daddy.
They gave you
life. Once you have a life, you can practice Buddhism. You can reach ultimate goals. That in itself, without anything else, without any good attitude on their side, or I have a lot of Americans say, well, my mother's lousy, Well, she's not, but anyway, just the suffering, just the suffering. She probably put out more suffering for you than anyone else ever will in this life. But the main thing is that no one can deny that they have given you a life, which you can use to practice, and you can reach the ultimate goals. There's two, I won't do three and four, I'll do two modes, how about that? One is,
Michael, you got Pembeshi. So far you said it means help.
Yeah.
That's
it? Means object. Object of help.
It
means
object of help.
Two of the five fall into here, mainly. Modes of thinking going on when you do, that also are in play. When you talk about what makes the deed an immediate deed, what makes it so bad, there's these two attitudes towards the Pembeshi. These two attitudes are in your mind towards the Pembeshi. The one is the rejection of them. One is to say, mentally, before you can kill your parents, you are rejecting the idea of, almost you're rejecting the idea of your own Buddhahood. See, it's some kind of rejection of the benefit they have given you. There's an attitude of rejection.
When you say it's like rejecting your own Buddhahood?
You'd have no recognition of what they are. You're rejecting that concept. You're rejecting the idea that they have given you this benefit. So the first part of the attitude is that you're rejecting your parents.
could you also say by extension you're rejecting, because of emptiness, you're rejecting that, you know, it's your projection, you're seeing, you know, your stuff, not really your parents, and it's your own inner karma.
Ultimately, if there's anything bad about your parents, it's you, and the day that you recognize that, you'll be close to arhatship, because then you won't do violence against this illusion. Okay. Rejection and elimination. Eliminate means you actually take steps to kill it. You create, the sutra says, you create conditions for the non-continuation of the black horse. So, you kill them. You eliminate them. So those are two attitudes going on. One is sort of a rejection. It's like a estrangement. You know, it's this thing I don't need, this is garbage, you know, you're getting ambitious. Say Yun Deng Yi Shi.
Yun Deng Yi Shi.
Yun Deng Yi Shi.
Yun Deng Yi Shi.
She is the same, it's the object. And Yun Deng means extraordinarily, I don't know how you say it. Yun Deng means an extraordinarily good personal quality. What would you call it? Fine qualities? Extraordinary qualities? And that applies to the last three. What were those?
Arhat, Sangha, and Buddha.
Yeah, Arhat, Sangha, and Buddha. In that order, actually. They are just an extraordinary, and we talked about it with the Bodhisattva. You know, it doesn't matter what your intention is much. It doesn't matter much how you undertake it. It doesn't, even the completion is not so important. It's just that they are so holy that anything you do towards them is magnified. And I always tell people, I think we mentioned, it's like somebody who has the last, if somebody had the last bottle of the last, of the only cure for AIDS, you know, if that were possible, if there could be a what do you call it, vaccine or, you know, some kind of elixir that would fix people with AIDS, which doesn't exist now. And if one person had the only, better than all the AIDS vaccines that were ever invented, it's more important and more rare in the world, more valuable. So that that person becomes a Yun Deng Yi Shi. Anyone who holds that bottle is a Yun Deng Yi Shi. You reject them and you eliminate them in two cases, right? You reject the arhat and you eliminate him. You reject the concept of unity of the sangha and you break it. What about the Buddha?
You try to eliminate.
Yeah, you don't eliminate. So they say, you know, when you're debating, you have to say, yeah, the elimination doesn't exist on the fifth one.
But they try to.
You try. You reject. Mentally, you reject a Buddha. And that apparently that rejection has a lot to do with the badness of the deed. The fact that you don't care anymore, or that you have no reverence or no feeling, you really believe this thing is garbage, and you undertake to kill it. The mental rejection of what he stands for is what gives the deed a lot of its power. And the same with the unity of a Dharma group. You know, it's very, very common. You know, a person takes his own interests or his own opinions to be more important than the unity of the group. And that's not true. That's not correct. You know, there's times when you have to, and it's hard for me. I'm a very stubborn and individualist person. But you know, there's times when you have to, you must keep your mind on the importance of the unity of that group, even if it's not exactly what you want. You know, and that's more important than your personal feelings at that moment. Yeah.
Does that go so far as to, you know, go along with the wrong view simply because the majority of the group really thinks it's true,
well, then you could
it would be divisive if you set them straight or attempted to?
I think normally what happens with a schism is that the person who's creating the schism really does believe they're correct. And normally it's a misconception. You know, the other people can see that the person is just being assertive, you know, or they're just being stubborn, or they're just hung up on what they want. And, it, you know, I'm not talking about these extraordinary cases where suddenly everybody in the Dharma group agrees that abortion is okay, and then and then you have to leave that group because you can't, you don't want to be a part of that. But that's a different thing. But I'm talking, the normal schisms that happen are personal differences between people, and they're not philosophical usually. You know, I mean, I wish they were. You know, no, if they were truly philosophical.
Well, look what's happening with the Kagyus. That's pretty deep.
I can't judge it. I don't know. But it's a terrible thing.
Certainly
it's a very terrible
deep
thing. It could happen to anybody. It could happen to us, too. I just don't want it. There'll come a time when you feel like it. There'll come a time when you really don't like somebody. And there'll come a time when you maybe even think you have a conviction that this thing is wrong. But examine it very carefully and try as hard as you can to. The unity of the Dharma is very important. It's really important. You just have to look at that. And now I'll give you the real thing. That unity is the Dharma body of the Buddha. That's what the scriptures say.
What's
the what? The Dharmakaya.
Which is the unity of the group.
Unity of this of a group, of Buddhist followers, is the Dharmakaya. I mean, it's an expression of the Dharmakaya. That's how heavy it is. And we'll talk more about it.
So how can you break the Dharmakaya even if you want to?
So can you tell us can you say a little more about that?
I will. I will say more about it. Okay. So that's what makes it. I'll say it in the next thing I'm going to present. And I'm going to finish on time. Which of them is least? Should I say that? Which do you think is the worst one of the five? Now I'm going to give you the five in order of badness. What's the worst one of the five? Isn't it worse to try to kill a Buddha?
You can't kill him.
Well, I try, isn't it?
But you could really break up. You could really break up the group.
No, but the bad deed is not to kill. The bad deed is to try to kill.
But you can't kill him, so it's not as bad as.
No, the bad deed is to try. The attempted murder of a Buddha is the bad deed of that's the five. It's in the five. It's not the killing. It's the attempted murder.
What's bad for you personally? As opposed to dividing up the sangha. Well, if it only lasts for 24 hours, then it's patched up.
Sleep it off.
That's more just for you again, personally, I suppose.
They say that the schism is the worst. Okay. From the point of view of the result, especially, it must have a result of one eon in the lowest hell. Must always.
Oh, if the result is bad for you, then you ought to have been that.
As far as the result. Also, they say, from the point of view of damage to the universe, you know, attempting to kill a Buddha is in a sense trying to hurt the form body, right? A schism, they say, is an attack on the Dharma body.
So the idea is there are many form bodies and one Dharma body?
That's true. Is it technically the Dharma body? Yeah, it is.
It's an aspect or manifestation of Dharma.
It is. It's his expression of his omniscience. It is his omniscience. I mean, that you can read it in the reading. It's an attack on the Dharma body. It's an attack on the body of the Dharma. And it's worse than an attack on his personal body.
Michael?
Yeah.
I understand that the extremist is actively trying to break up the sangha, but what if when you didn't know better you made some bitchy comments?
you know, it's good that you would wonder because it's probably motivated by that you did it. Our practice is the practice of concentric circles. I heard a monk, Dobum Tuku, explain it to me one time. He was the Dalai Lama's assistant for a long time. And, you know, a monk is not supposed to have sex with a woman. And so he has to stay in this little circle here. Then outside of that, he can't touch a woman. And outside of that, he can't look. And outside of that, he can't spend too much time with a woman. And then like that, outside of that, he said, eventually you get to this outside circle. Okay? If I never go within this circle, I'll never go within this circle. You know, it just cannot happen. So the morality, they say, is the same. You stay out here. You know, don't let yourself say anything bad about your fellow Dharma students. If you don't let yourself think anything bad. If you don't, then you won't get to say anything bad. If you don't, you won't get to say anything that splits them up. If you don't split them up, you know what I mean? keep yourself, the idea of morality is to keep yourself away. When we do our confession, we say, you know, we confess the deed, the bad deed. Then we confess the preparation for the deed. And then we confess the preparation for the preparation for the deed. And then we think, we confess the thought to get ready to prepare to do the deed. So, I mean, when you're doing your monk confession. So you have to stay that far away. Stay outside. It's just your morality is like that. You're not going to kill somebody. You're not going to burn down this modest little dharma center. But you would, you have to stay on the outside. You have to stay in that last circle. You know, stay outside of that last circle. Don't even let yourself think it. If you don't think it, you'll never do it. It's very important. It's really, really very important. There will come a day when it's important. You know, I mean, let's think about it now. Keep it in mind now. It's a big, bad deed.
You said earlier that as, say, the group it progresses, that there's more of a chance that would happen. Why would that be?
Well, not necessarily, I think. You can have the groups that get sweeter and sweeter, right? But I think it's still a little bit new for everyone. You know, like the group out in New Jersey, we've been there for 20 years. And
there's never been anything.
There's never been anything. We're very lucky. But what I mean is, I mean in the sense of getting hardened to the sweetness of the Dharma. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, once you've heard what I'm saying a few times, the third time you hear me explain this thing, it won't be very fresh. And you'll be thinking, I wish he would tell us something new tonight. And that's a very bad attitude. Mm-hmm. I mean, I go to Rinpoche's classes, I still go to all his beginning classes. It's just supposed to get deeper and deeper and sweeter and sweeter. What I'm saying is it could reach a point where you get more and more hardened to it, because you didn't take steps when you first heard it to do something. So it's very important that the first time, the first few years of your Dharma study, is very crucial, because you won't be as open to it later. Okay. I mean, it's crucial to actually carry it out, to actually start changing if you can, because later you won't. There's nothing different about the second time you hear it that's going to make you change it the first time you didn't. Okay. What's the second worst one? Yeah, attack on the Buddha. Third? Fourth?
Mama.
Right. And the poor guy is always getting that. All right. Those are the order of severity.
The Bodhisattva is not in there. Turn the Bodhisattva on.
Now that you mention it,
Mahayana.
No, it is. They do have Bodhisattvas in the Abhidhamma. I used to get real confused. I'll give you the five near bad. I mean, there's a second five. They're called the close ones, and they say they're close because they're close to the five, close to the five immediate. And it's not on your homework anymore, but I just thought you'd like to know. The first one is to
the order of severity or
traditional? I don't know. This is a traditional order. I don't know about severity. First one is to rape your mother, who is also an arhat.
You're an arhat and she is? Or
no,
she
is both. Okay. She's both your mother and arhat. That's pretty terrible. Second one is to kill a bodhisattva who is called a bodhisattva of certainty. And certainty in this case means he only has 100 kalpas to go. Seriously.
Only 160,000 years each one.
No. Trillions of years. Okay.
Only 100
kalpas to go. To kill any one of the seven high practitioners.
Which you want?
I don't know exactly. But I believe it's people who have achieved the path of seeing. And to steal the property of the Sangha.
That's cool.
Yeah. That's something I can do. We can do that. And what's the last one? The last one they say is the one which is parallel to trying to harm the Buddha, and that's to out of a feeling of anger or hatred, etc. So I guess it's any one of those things. To destroy images or altars or temples. So those are the five. I think keeping the finances in the jungle, I keep them pretty creative. But anyway.
And these will also go to hell?
Yeah. They say, well, what's the difference then? And they say it's a little bit lighter. I mean, there's a big debate about it. The result is also to go to hell. These five, these secondary five.
In the next life.
It's not very clear to me, I'll tell you the truth. It seems to be in the next life. And they say it's a little bit lighter, and then they say that's what the Abhidharma say, meaning they probably don't believe that. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't spend much time on it. Somebody in the reading, you'll see, they come up and they debate and they say, didn't the Buddha say that the most serious bad deeds were the mental ones? And then they say, yes, he did say that. And they say, that was only with regard to the three passageways. What are the three passageways? Body, speech, and mind. So the first three of the ten, he said, when the Buddha said that, he was talking about the ten bad deeds. The first three are physical, the next four are verbal, the last three are mental. So of those three divisions, the mental ones are the most powerful, are the worst. And then somebody says, well, wouldn't killing be worse than having a wrong view? And then he gives the example of this meditator who murdered people in his concentrations. But anyway, not a Buddhist, but worse, the mental ones are much worse. And then they say, which of the five? Then they quote another scripture that says lokta, which is one. That wrong view is the worst. So they say, well, what? That's not even in those five. And he says, no, when they say wrong view is the worst, they're referring to the five bad views. And wrong view is the worst one.
Five bad views?
There are five bad views.
What is that?
Huh?
What is that?
It's not part of the lesson tonight, but just if you want to know. Okay. It'll take you to 9:05 if you don't mind. And I don't do them in order, all right? One is called Tanzingitao. That means to believe that everything exists the way it looks to you. And on the other hand, to think that if it didn't exist the way it looks to you today, it doesn't exist at all. And nothing matters. So those are called extreme views. Those are called extreme view. You can see how you could flop from one to the other. We live in the one. The minute someone talks us out of it, we flip to the other one. That's one. Jigsomatawa is to take you and what belongs to you as being self-existent. That's actually the nature of the first link of the wheel of life. Tsujin dan tushu chonzingitawa means to practice mistaken kinds of morality and asceticisms and think that that's a great thing. You know, the examples are, there was a school in India that said you should meditate for years and years, then plant a spear face up, a trident, and then you should be standing on a chair, you know, and you should jump down on it, and if it goes through exactly through here and through here, and if you have the right motivation, then you achieve nirvana at that moment. And that's, you know, or you've seen things where people beat them. To practice mistaken kinds of morality and asceticisms and think that that's a great thing. You know, the examples are, there was a school in India that said you should meditate for years and years, then plant a spear face up, a trident, and then you should be standing on a chair, you know, and you should jump down on it, and if it goes through exactly through here and through here, and if you have the right motivation, then you achieve nirvana at that moment. And that's, you know, or you've seen things where people beat themselves. And you've seen people who practice things with the... I've seen people in Buddhist centers who were told to do a certain number of prostrations. They did it. It got to a point where it hurt them, physically handicapped them. And they were told to go on, and then now they can't walk straight. They can't walk. They have to use a cane. You know, that's you have to use common sense. Your body is very precious. You have to take care of it. You can't hurt yourself. You know, just going and being hungry or being cold or being hot is no big shakes. When you go into meditation, you want to be very comfortable. You know, I stock up on every kind of food I want. And it's important. Quiet, happy, comfortable, healthy, bright. You know, concentrated. That's the idea. It's not to hurt yourself. Then there's Dawa Chongzin, which means to think that your wrong views are great. It's another kind of wrong view. This is really good. But when I say that, it doesn't mean that, you know, if you do your retreats, your literals, it's a 4, 5, 6 week thing, and it hurts a lot. I mean, there are times where it really hurts. That's a different thing. Then you've got to have guts and keep going. That's a different thing. I'm talking about damaging yourself permanently. But, and also, if your mind starts to get crazy, you have to stop. But to stick it out when it's getting unpleasant is a different thing. You have to do that too. Okay, last wrong view is what? Oh, that's it. I need 5. Extreme view. Mm-hmm. View of me and myself, mm-hmm. which is called view of the perishable self. What was the other?
Practice mistaken, right.
Being glad that you.
Yeah, that was 4.
Asceticism.
That was 3. And in 4, Lokta. Did we miss one?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah. 5.
Did you do the one about being glad you lost your wrong view?
No.
Did we do it?
I got 4.
Mm-hmm. Thinking your views are the best, and then wrong view. Backwards view. Don't we have 5 yet? Let's do it here.
Thinking your views are great, and then wrong view.
We can say extreme view. And then you could so call perishable view. And then you could mistaken morality. And then and practice with that. Meaning extreme, extremism.
Mm-hmm.
And then, thinking your views are best. And then, the classic wrong view, which is where you say, no, karma doesn't exist. If I do my bad deeds in private, and no one ever finds out, and everything's okay, and I'm fine.
You made a point of saying the presentation was Abhidhamma. Any difference between my head and what the...
In these 5 views, no. Same.
No, the other...
Basically, Mahayana accepts almost all the details of the Samme, of the 5 views. There's a few details that are not... What do you think... for example, an Abhidharmist would say you get an aura from a Samme, from an immediate bad view. What happens if you commit 2? What if you do 2 in 1 line?
You get an aura from a bad thing?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Any powerful karmic thing you get an aura.
Oh, I
think
that was
you take a vow to serve in the army, you get an aura.
You get 2 of
them. They say your aura gets heavier, brighter, something like that. And then there's a big argument about, does the second one ripen in the very next life? Because then, what, both of them ripen in the next life? Because if it ripens in the life after, if it has to wait in line to ripen in the next, well, then it's not an immediate. And you can imagine why they're different. Okay. So be happy you're doing really, just to talk about these things is great.
In the Madhyamika Prasangika, you describe for me the whole progression of
just
you create a karma, what happens, the deed, the baksha.
Everything's the same, except where it stays. Amazing, it just stays in there.
So you do a deed,
the end of the deed, the bhakshat results, stays in the simple me, has the potential.
You can say stream of money and it's all right. They don't mind.
Okay. Has the potential to be pain or pleasure in the future when it arises. The thing that I would like clarification on is the aspect of the how this bhakshat arises as your perception, and ultimately when you collect enough bhakshats, how that arises as your projection of enlightenment.
If I had only two, I would never be
caught. I don't get it, though. I mean, I don't get.
Oh, it's just this. There is data. There is outside data.
Yeah.
And then you interpret. So there is wet and tone.
Yeah.
And you and the way the bhakti operates is that creates your impression from it.
Right.
It creates your interpretation. And you don't have a choice.
Wow.
I think that's where most people fall down. First is nihilism. Say, if they're one of those rare teachers that gets to the point of explaining how the bhakti works, then the student swings to this extreme of thinking that they could willingly control it.
Well, and how do you...
Just through, you can program your perception through patterning, essentially.
Well,
perceptual patterning is what I'm talking about. Yeah. Will, force of mind. Yeah.
If it happens, certain things happen that night.
You mean as a result of it?
Well, have it done.
Uh-huh. That's by the way why temporary doctors is worth it. You decide to take a risk in business. It works out in more cases than not. Or something.
So you have this wet, this matter, this substance, this wet and flowing, this that arises for some reason, that you encounter for some reason, and you're a bhakshat.
Actually, that's also when you focus on the wet, it's also
Right. All the way down to the smallest and smallest plants. But the idea is that you have to encounter the wet. Whatever it is that you're calling wet, you have to encounter the infinite smaller parts that you're labeling as wet. So whatever it is that arises in your encounter that you interact with and label and project onto, your bhakshat causes that arisal and encounter. And in the case of enlightenment, then you've done so many good deeds and you have so many positive bhakshats that the stuff that arises can only be the raw material, if you will, of positive interpretation, pleasurable interpretation.
Ultimately, everything.
So, in the case of me seeing myself as a Buddha when I become enlightened, it's because, not because I just fooled myself into seeing myself as a Buddha, then, as Tom would say. Because where I get confused is this aspect of tricking yourself into seeing yourself a certain way.
The point is, this is this whole point. It is only a projection.
Trying not to.
It is only a projection.
It's not tricking yourself.
It is only a projection. Yeah. That's all anything out of.
Right, I understand that.
Now, is there a conscious thing you can do pretending that?
That's the issue. The issue is that I normally think of perception, it's a learned behavior.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, you will plant the bhakshats that will cause you.
But there are
practices that we can't talk about.
Right. So the idea of this learned behavior is not what we would normally think of as like.
You see, when you're talking about that particular level.
I'm not talking about tantric practice. I'm just talking about, like, if I sit down here and I say everything's empty, and I intellectually remind myself that everything's empty, that's a learned behavior.
That's true.
That's a learned pattern that I'm creating.
It's learned.
And so does that learned pattern result in my experiencing, does my sitting here saying everything's empty and, oh, yeah, I'm perceiving my projections and these arisings, and does that result in a pleasurable bhakshat being planted
ultimately.
That results that arises later that I must see.
Noble, Yeah. It depends on your intention. If you're studying emptiness for the purpose of getting pleasure from yourself, and not harming people, and you do not, you know, the result would be Hinayana. The perceptual result would be
So the idea is that the collection of merit, the idea of the collection of merit is that it requires a vast number of bhakchaks leading to pleasurable perception.
It's a very cold and self-interested process.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, people object to that. I don't see it. I think if Buddhism is a method, if it really is a method, and it should be a transferable, transmittable, cold scientific method.
Right, right, right.
You do these things, you will get that result.
Right.
And you do it quite knowingly and purposefully and self-interestedly, and that's, there's no problem with that. That's fine. That's what you do. And that will help you prioritize your good deeds. There's lots of good deeds you can do. And I think when you get it to a certain point, you got to start to...
Shoot.
You know, you only have a few years left.
So I'm setting out to do this collection of as much and many positive, pleasurable bhakti chaks as possible. And the idea is that my nirvana or my enlightenment will be nothing but the ripening of pleasant bhakti chaks that I must be forced to see in a certain way.
With the perception, with this knowledge. And that's the whole meaning of knowledge.
So here's the key for me, is if I have a bhakti chak, which is to bring me pain, say it's a past bad deed, and it say, and I have this intellectual understanding of emptiness, and in this negative seed arises, and somebody hits me on the head, and I go, oh well, you know, karma, emptiness, net. I understand it. You know, it doesn't really bother me so much, but I still get hit on the head and it hurts. You know, is this Is this bhakchak that just arose and caused me pain, but not a full pain? You know,
right.
Is in some way, or in some way, are in some way these negative bhakchaks being mitigated and lessened by my overall patterning? You know, does that make sense?
Yes.
It does work that way.
Yeah, it doesn't. By the way, what would be the practical result? You know, you would look like a fool.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't respond with when ignorant people, which are called infants in the scriptures, think you should respond. And you would act in a different way.
Uh-huh.
You'd act like Jesus himself.
Right.
Jesus up there.
When everybody says
nails put into him.
It's okay.
And he's saying, you know, I don't want to offend him by him enough. Or whatever. Or he's actually it doing
forgives
a
father.
He's praying for you know, in the classical interpretation, he's using that suffering and wishing that it could represent the suffering of all of you. That's the classic reaction to suffering. That would be the most profound reaction to anything you didn't like. And they're not going to nail you up on the cross. The guy's going to come in the office and nail you. That'll be your chance.
Mm-hmm. In Majjhimika Prasangika, the idea of everything is our perception. I have a tendency, you know, we talk about projecting onto the blank screen. I have a tendency to see myself projecting outward onto things. And I think what it really is everything coming into me and being interpreted internally, not me projecting myself and my perceptions outward. It's like a drawing in.
I think there is a psychological. There's a whole separate thing from a separate bhakti that you might tend to project. You know, psychological projection is much different than karmic projection. Psychological projections, when I go into the bus, I look at women's fingers and look at their diamonds. I can't stop myself. Mm-hmm. They all look at me like...
That's not psychological, that's just practical.
No, and then those people who sell shoes, they're always looking at the shoes. You know, that's some kind of psychological projection.
But that's not projection, Michael. Projection is when you change something
to a color.
It's interpretation.
Well, first of all, it's your karma to look at rings.
It's just your focusing.
I can't believe everybody's wearing these rings today. You know, it's not that everybody's wearing these rings today.
Projection is more like you...
Well, you see everybody as nasty because you're nasty.
Yeah, because you're feeling...
That's it. Ultimately, you're karmic yourself. But it's not the kind of projection I'm talking about.
What I'm talking about, for example, I look around this room and I go yellow wall, white, you know, white, red table, you know, statue, etc. And rather than me projecting outward onto matter and stuff out there. I'm really taking all this stuff in to me, and it's like in a way staying in me and being processed in me and registering in me, and it's like the world is almost in me happening, if that makes sense.
The day that you perceive not ultimate reality, but the day that you perceive relative reality, which is a big deal, it happens the same day, when you catch yourself doing what you're doing, which has nothing to do with infinite, it's the projection process, when you finally see yourself doing it, and you do have the sensation of it being inside the head, that it's all happening right behind the edge of your eyeball. You see what I mean? There is that. And if you're looking, the object that you're looking at, the parts are external.
It's all the interpretation is internal.
But the perfection, the perfect image of that thing is in your mind. And all you ever saw is that. All you ever reacted to is that.
Yeah, there's all definitely all this stuff out there, but it's not.
It's there. It's that is out there.
All the. Yeah, perception is in there.
So at the level of Tantra, this idea of reprogramming your perception?
You mean kirim, which means pretending to be attending.
Well, generation
and that's
space.
True. No, yeah, that's generation space, yeah. That's okay.
But it, does it actually do anything
other
than plant seeds for completion stage?
No, it doesn't. It has its own function.
What does it actually do?
You really want to know?
Yeah.
The virtue of trying is a tongue in it. It's a lay that ripens in this life.
Just from trying.
What is this? I remember.
So visualizing yourself with a light, not even the channels, not even the basic channels and trying.
That's over here.
Yeah, not even that. Just the light body of the right, of the form body.
Yeah, and all the things that it means. I mean, you have to be. There's a section in the commentary that says just pretending to have that color and shape that has very little effect. It's trying to imagine what it would be like to be such a holy person.
So in terms of the specialness of the practice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you just did your long room meditations,
it would work, but taking a longer.
So how is it that you still have to remember your long room meetings when you're doing the Tantra, so how is it that speeds anything up?
The virtue of trying.
Wouldn't that simply still apply to the long room? Trying the
long room. The virtue of believing. It's really the main element is the virtue of believing that everything around you is already
empty?
No.
Oh, a deity realm.
Believing it. There's no mistake.
This is where I get into the question of just willing it, the perception.
No, that's
aspect.
Very close to willing it. What it does is it is a karmic result. It is a normal process in the box of being planted. But it's so powerful that it starts to work in this way.
This is what I was asking you before about just.
No, there is a real.
Yourself.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And that's true. That's a tone you can. It fits into the Abhidharma system.
But how is that different than willing yourself to see, to not see something as painful? See what I mean?
It's got the background of sutra practice. It's got this background of sutra knowledge. So you're doing all the right things. Mm-hmm. But you can't. Even that doesn't work immediately. Tone you can name it later on. But there's a special virtue. To not doubting that already the world around you is dead and everyone in you is dead.
So it's that box shot that you're getting that speeds things up.
Yeah.
And that's the same idea with seeing your deity, your teacher as the Buddha.
Yeah.
Same concept of that special virtue that speeds things up.
Yeah.
That's strange somehow that there's a special virtue just by being willing to believe.
Yeah, when Rinpoche gets to tantric, he says, God is too on that level. But then when he's teaching logic, he says, everything has to be logical. No, but it is logical, the belief.
Well, it follows that you can believe because everything else has made sense.
Yeah.
But that there would be a virtue associated with simple, pure belief.
Yeah, so there it is.
Interesting.
Not just belief, but, like a conviction that it has to be true.
Acting based upon that, living based upon
that.
In a way, it's not saying you believe this. It's saying that my life is based upon this, and I'm acting based upon this.
Yeah.
Is this why it's the resultant path? Because you're just making it happen now by force of will, essentially?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me.
Yeah.
It almost seems to me like you are willing yourself to to think and act that way, yeah. And so it results, and therefore it is.
Yeah. And just the good karma of acting on that is enough to make it happen.
It's almost to me like the whole body of the deity and all the external body of the deity and all that. It's a trapping. If you have this mental idea of I am an enlightened being now,
well, you get both.
Either way,
you get both.
If you forget about a particular form of Vajrayogini or Yoga Talk, I'm saying that outer form, you know.
Well, I'd say more the fact that I'm an internal one.
Right, that's what I'm talking about. If you just say I am an enlightened being, I channel those of an enlightened being. They're like this, and you know, my behavior, my thoughts are like this. I'm an enlightened being. Just that is resultant, not sitting there. I'm red externally. I have a red light body or a blue light body, or you know, like that. You know what I mean?
Well, I think at a point, it's more like recognizing what's there than trying to imagine. You see, if your sutra practice is good, I think it's more that. It starts happening to you, not that you're trying to. It's just a recognition of what's happening.
And so it almost seems to me like it's more important to just pay attention to the idea of the concepts in the channels and those visualizations, rather than my body's red externally, you know, red light body or blue light body, and let that come on its own, and whatever sort of manifests as it manifests. Like. Is that wrong?
Well, I think whatever your teacher tells you, you know, yeah. Any time, right. Teacher, I think you have to follow that. I've never regretted, you know, there's been things that were very hard for me, like sitting down for a month and doing 100,000 mantras. It just didn't seem like something that I wanted to do. But I did it, and I had a nice result.
I'm thinking of doing it, maybe in this next couple of months.
That's a great thing.
Is there anything to be preparing, in, you know, like now?
You gotta think, there's this Mundo practice, right?
Right.
The Galupa Mundo is to do some extraordinary mantras.
That's it.
So it could be anything. It could be whatever you choose.
So like giving money or, I mean...
Finishing the study of one particular book. Something extraordinary.
I don't know what qualifies as extraordinary.
Pick something.
Huh? Pick something?
This is the end of Class 9.